This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week that's out later this week, the next story you can find actually right now on the Bloomberg Terminal and also at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Tim, is about how women are smashing the construction industry's concrete ceiling.
Record vacancies forcing changes in what's been an all-male bastion. We've got with us one of the authors, Maria Paola Mijares Torres, joins us now. She's U.S. economy reporter for Bloomberg News. She's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Maria, I want to start just with the data here. We're talking 14.1%, an all-time high in terms of the share of U.S. construction jobs held by women. It's not by any means parity, but this is a big deal.
Yeah, it's 1 million women in construction, which is a higher number we have seen raising since data was collected in 1964. And, you know, with more, as we call them, baby boomers, or more people who were used to being in this industry, male, are retiring, and there's more vacancies in this industry, and there's labor shortages, and people are looking for jobs, more women are taking them.
All right, I got to say, I have two brothers who are contractors. I don't hear a lot about them working with a bunch of women in the industry. So how is it that it's happening?
Yeah, it's still a minority, but it's growing. And that's why that's what caught us from the data and we wanted to do this story. Because there's a lot of women seeing that they have more opportunities of, you know, growing professionally, having a higher wage, if they, instead of, you know, go have other jobs that are stereotypical for women,
right?
They take this construction works that, you know, have no gender attached to them. It's just like in history, more men have done it and they have more opportunities there. So they've been falling in love with these construction works and been doing them more and more, inspiring other women to also do that.
It's also the money is really, really good. Take us through some of the numbers here, because we're talking, you know, close to $100,000 a year for jobs that don't necessarily require a college education.
Yeah. Exactly. So in the median salary for an electrician in 2021 was $59,000 and $98,500 for a construction manager. So that's why a lot of women are being appealed to these jobs that, you know, some women actually do have college degrees, even though it's not required. For example, one of the people I talked with, Viridiana Cerrato, she has a degree in history and Latin American studies. She just couldn't find a job that, you know, she also graduated in 2020 with the pandemic. She couldn't find a job that was for what she wanted to do.
Right.
And then she fell in love with construction because she had seen how her partner, her dad, grew up doing construction. She just never felt identified there. She never saw Latina women of color or women in general just working in the construction fields where their family were working. And she realized that she can do it and get a better salary than what she was hoping for.
So what are women in construction typically doing? Are they overseeing sites? Are they doing the contracts, negotiations with clients, or are they actually picking up a hammer and doing some of the physical work? Because it's a very physical job.
It is a very physical job, and it also has very various facets.
Yeah.
We see women from any part of the construction. We see And they already go with talk with women who are actual constructors. Speaking of the hammers, like you said, we see contractors, we see inspectors, we see from manager positions all the way to the bottom. Of course, as the higher you up you go in the ladder, there's more men and specifically more white men. But
no, really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But that's what they're actually trying to build. And I saw
I was that. Having fun with the world.
Yeah.
Not you.
Exactly.
Well, so, yeah, go ahead, Carol.
No, and it is interesting, and I do. I remember watching This Old House, and this was a few years ago, because there's such demand for jobs generally in the construction industry. There's a lot of younger individuals who don't think about becoming electricians. We talk about this all the time, or, you know, becoming contractors, or, you know, becoming builders, and they really need people, and they were actually creating a program to help cultivate young women, young men in this industry. And so it's kind of interesting. Is the growth expected to continue? Is so much of it, though, about the demand in the industry right now that women have a better opportunity?
Well, I really do hope that it keeps growing until it's more equitable or more equal. People are definitely seeing how it's not longer stereotyped as only one gender can do this kind of job. So more doors are being open for women. And a lot of the women I spoke with, they're saying that they're finding more and more community, and they all got inspired to do this work thanks to other women telling them, hey, there's an opportunity here.
Yeah.
From Facebook groups to actual networking groups in person to go grab lunch together. Mm. This was something that women just got inspired to do more and more by hearing other people doing it.
What did they tell you about just day-to-day life on the construction site? I mean, I worked construction for 2 summers in college, and it was all male where I was. Mm-hmm. There was not a single woman on these working on these houses. What did they tell you about the environment?
Yeah, definitely the environment is not the most friendly for a woman. They all told me that they have had a couple of bad experiences in the sense of either harassment, either not taking them seriously because they're a woman. If there were inspectors overseeing a job done by a man, they would usually second guess them and say, hey, I did this correctly. You have to like revise it again. And they say like, no, my word is final. So they were a lot of times not respected as they would hope to. But that's also why this community matters of women in construction coming together so they can support each other. And they've all have told me that they have had to grow a thick skin in this job.
Tell us, too, about minority women, how this is even an extra bump up for them.
Yeah. So, a lot of the percentages of women working are kind of mixed ethnically and race-wise. The biggest minority in women in construction are Latino women. Mm-hmm. I was able to talk with a couple of them. But yeah, this is somewhere also where you see all side of the spectrums, but of course also majority white women. But more and more, they're telling me that they're seeing more women of color in this industry. But just in general, if you look at also on their male counterparts, it's also been hard to see more people, young people and people of color higher up in the ladder.
Is this a consequence, or I shouldn't even say consequence, is this the result of just the labor shortage that we're seeing? I mean, what is spurring the increased diversification when it comes to at least gender diversity within construction?
Yeah, that's some of the guesses that experts have on the matter because of the labor shortage and the lack of people in construction that's needed. They're accepting more people now. But I really do hope that even if the labor shortage ever, you know, ceases, these opportunities keep open for more people.
Yeah, I got to say, I know I've said this a million times, so forgive Bloomberg audience, but I just remember our electrician, or I think it was our plumber, and just...
When you got the bill?
Well, the bill, and then he retiring early, and his multiple homes that he owned, and the money that was to be made, and, you know, we're so pro-college, and I am very pro-college, but there are alternatives where you can make a really, really good living, and certainly this is, certainly when it comes to construction, playing out well for women, and in particular, minority women. Maria Paola Mijares Torres, U.S. economy reporter at Bloomberg News, in our Interactive Brokers studio. This story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, due out later this week, but you can find it at the Bloomberg right now and also at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic. on Bloomberg Radio.
It is one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg. It's also the Bloomberg Big Take about how the U.S. central bank's past crises hold secrets to tackling future recessions. We can indeed, Tim, it seems, learn from our past.
That story by Tom Orlick and David Wilcox. Carol, as you mentioned, it's today's Big Take. Check it out from Bloomberg, the Big Take, on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/a Big Take. Tom Orlick is chief economist for Bloomberg Economics. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Tom, good to have you with us this afternoon. I find it fascinating to see what's happening in the S&P 500 right now since we last heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell with, you know, the most recent meeting of the Federal Reserve, because we've seen stocks rally. And you and David write that the market isn't really buying the fact that the federal funds rate is going to have to keep climbing to tame inflation.
Yeah, it's funny, Tim. There's a bunch of people in the markets who have a deep investor background. There's a bunch of people in the markets who have a policy background, including some folks on our team who joined us from time at the Federal Reserve, and they just had completely different interpretations of that July press conference from Chair Powell. The market folks heard a dovish signal. They heard what they wanted to hear. They heard the Fed was going to pause on rate hikes. The policy people, the people with the monetary policy, the Fed background, they didn't hear that at all. They heard a Powell who was determined to push on with rate hikes until inflation is under control. So far it's that first interpretation, that dovish interpretation, which has been pushing the S&P and other risk assets up. Our view is actually that's the wrong interpretation, and we expect that Powell's going to come out at Jackson Hole and offer a correction.
All right, so he'll say what specifically?
So I think there's a range of possible outcomes for inflation and for Fed policy in the months ahead. Goodness knows economists haven't got everything right on the big inflation call or the monetary policy call so far. So the market view, it's not insane. It's not outside the range of possible outcomes. At the same time, it's not at the center of the distribution. It's not the most likely path that the Fed is going to have to follow. I think that there's going to be an acknowledgement of progress so far, but Powell's going to be a long way from declaring mission accomplished. He's going to signal that dovish pause, putting too much money betting on that, probably not a very good idea.
Well, let's talk about the Fed's credibility here, Tom, because it's something that you and David write about. You both write about the fact that the Federal Reserve has lost control of inflation. And I'm wondering if the two of you, based on your reporting, think that it has the tools necessary to bring it down. Because, and you look, you go back to the, you know, tall Paul era, Paul Volcker, raising rates to 20%.
So the Fed absolutely has the tools to bring inflation under control. The question today is the same as the question back in 1980 at that Paul Volcker moment, which you mentioned. What's the cost of bringing inflation under control? Back then, the cost was a deep recession, millions of people unemployed. Today, well, no one thinks the cost is going to be quite so high, but inflation is running at 6%, more than 6%, three times the Fed's 2% target. Bringing it all the way back to 2% is going to come at a cost in higher unemployment, potentially at the cost of a recession for the U.S. economy.
You know, it's interesting, Tom, you're right, eventually inflation will be back on target and any immediate recession will end. There is, though, that conversation that maybe the targets are not going to be the ones of the future, that maybe those targets, especially inflationary targets, it's more like 3 or 4% going forward, that will be, forgive me, the new norm rather than maybe a 2% rate.
So if we go back, if we wind the clock back to 2019, the biggest challenge for central banks was that they were in a world where inflation was too low. And what that meant was that when recessions hit, they didn't have enough room to cut rates. They didn't have enough room to stimulate the economy. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of different ways of kind of solving that problem. Quantitative easing, forward guidance, they're both ways of adding a bit of extra policy space for central banks after they already take interest rates to zero. Another out-of-the-box solution is to move to a higher inflation target. Let's target 3% inflation, not 2% inflation, and then when bad times come, we'll have more room to cut. So that was the conversation in 2019. who knows, it could become the conversation again looking out to 2024, 2025. Right now, though, with inflation really at a painful level for households and the Fed determined to bring inflation expectations under control, it's probably not the conversation which the Fed wants to be having.
God, this is makes that Jackson Hole meeting that more important. Tom, thank you so much. Bloomberg Economics Chief Economist Tom Orlik. Lots of news out of China. We know Beijing has been working to curb the influence of tech industry leaders from Tencent to Alibaba Group. A lot of this has to do with also even delisting from U.S. exchanges.
Yeah, really excited to speak to Kevin Carter, the founder of EMQQ. It's an emerging markets, internet and e-commerce ETF. Kevin, great to have you with us. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me.
I should say you're joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Okay, so when I think of China, especially in the last few months, I think of that call that JP Morgan made a few months ago, calling China's stock market uninvestable. Then they came out and said that that was actually published in error. But I'll just ask you, what were your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, you know, that day and that week, which was the middle of March, was a pretty volatile period for these companies. And the problem is the delisting threat of all the things, you know, that China faces and all the risks for investors. It's the most misunderstood. And in my estimation, it's the smallest risk, but it doesn't seem to matter because it moves the markets. And what we saw last week was that the state-owned enterprises, the Chinese government is going to delist the state-owned enterprises. And I think this is a real positive move in solving the dispute, because it's those companies that China is particularly sensitive to having the U.S. government auditors noodle around in.
Yeah, but I do wonder about Beijing, Chinese officials, it seems chronically getting involved in their private industry. You know what I mean? Like setting rules, setting regulations, dialing back, dialing forward, helping out the economy, COVID lockdowns. Like it's really, I think, tricky for investors to kind of know what truly is coming when it comes to making an investment in a well-known Chinese company.
Well, let me first talk about the regulatory, quote-unquote, crackdown. And the reality is that all over the world, you have these giant tech platforms, the FANG stocks here in the U.S., and they've grown at incredible rates, and they've taken over our lives and our stock markets, and the regulators haven't really been able to keep up with them. And that's not a China situation. That's a global situation. And you see it here. You know, all of our FANG executives are up in front of Congress, and the only difference is we have lobbyists and money involved. And the Chinese, I think, are able to take a longer-term view. And I think it's healthy what they've done, particularly with the, you know, Ant Group IPO. So people can look at it negatively and think, oh, my gosh, the Chinese government is, you know, they're not capitalists. They're going to, you know, Jack Ma's missing, et cetera. But I think the reality is that they're just trying to regulate like everybody else is.
Well, come on. You can't compare regulatory environment in China with the regulatory environment in a European market or the U.S. market. Can you? I mean, there's regulatory oversight where there is a process and then there's Jack Ma going missing. Like, I'm just saying, how can you compare them?
Well, China, I think, has advantages in regulatory matters. Remember, most of these people, a large percentage of their leaders have gone to our best colleges, particularly the financial system. Some of them have taught at our best colleges and they're smart and they need to regulate just as everyone else does. And in each sector is a little different, but I think the concerns that the Chinese government is going to, you know, squash capitalism are greatly overblown. And the delisting threat in and of itself is the dumbest part of all the fears that people have. It's the smallest risk. It's a very small risk that it happened, and it's an even smaller risk that anybody loses any money. Delisting does not equal you lose your money.
Well, what should be the risks that investors should be concerned about then, if that's, you know, in your words, the dumbest?
Well, the COVID. China hasn't had the COVID yet. I mean, they've got it there now, and they're trying to battle it. And the COVID zero policy puts them in a very tough situation because, you know, they have on one hand, if they have COVID zero, there's going to be continued meaningful economic damage and consumer confidence issues. And you're going to have people continue rise and unrest. People don't want to be locked in their apartments for multiple month-long periods. And I think that is a slow motion thing that's playing out, because if they don't have zero COVID, then they're going to lose a lot of people. And they've continued to stick with zero COVID. And I think it's a very tough position that they're in, trying to manage both.
Kevin, we've got to run. Kevin Carter, he is founder of EMQQ, joining us on the phone from San Francisco and talking about certainly Chinese companies and some of the regulatory environment.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've got with us Caterina Simonetti, Senior VP and Private Wealth Advisor over at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management. She joins us on the phone from Philadelphia. Caterina, I feel like there are so many mixed messages, whether it's some of the weakening housing data, but we did have inflation data start to come down, still high on a historical basis. Fed's still saying they're going to be largely, you know, aggressive, continue to raise rates. And then companies coming out and saying things are pretty good and we've got a tight labor market. How do you trade on this?
Carol, thank you for having me on the show. You've said it best. You know, the data is confusing. We had really positive labor market data, and that, of course, gives us confidence. And investors seem to believe that Fed will not slow down and start slowing down and rate hikes. As a matter of fact, you know, there is some possibility that they will even start cutting into the next year. You know, but all of this is despite of the fact that we're still having high inflation, which of course affects consumer confidence, that has been shaken by the fact that, you know, we haven't seen inflation at this level yet, you know, historically. We are dealing with weakened economic data, declining earnings, just overall geopolitical risks, and not to mention that the question is all of this going to bring us into, you know, an environment of an extra recession, and how major this recession is going to be. So the question is, what should investors do, right?
Right. Sorry, well, I just want to jump in, Caterina. What should investors do? Because it seems like the equity market is not taking into account the environment that you described just now. We're up close to 18% from those June lows in the S&P 500.
Well, Tim, I think that the important message here is that even though we are on the path to recovery, this path might lay through additional volatility. So what investors can do right now is we encourage them to realize losses, stay defensive in defensive sectors like financials, energy, healthcare, consumer staples. We're looking for additional yield generation for the stocks with strong cash flows that will generate income that is much needed here. The other side is that
So you're talking about dividend payers, correct?
That absolutely. We're talking about dividend-paying stocks and the focus on the defensive sectors. Not to mention that the bond market is also showing a sign of improvement. While we're not quite confident that this is the end of the bear market, as a matter of fact, our view is that this rally is more of a bear market rally and the volatility is going to continue. Bond market is showing the signs of improvement, and it can act like corporate bonds can act like a safe haven for investors in this time of, you know, volatility. Because the really real question here is, are we going to get a recession or not once that starts rate hikes? And that's a major question out there.
When will we know if the bear market rally is no longer a bear market rally and it's just a rally?
So here's what it would take for the improvement in the market and the improvement in the economy to truly be sustainable. It will take positive earnings. It will take curbed inflation. It will take rebound consumer confidence. And when all of this comes together, then we can confidently say that we're back in the bull market territory. And we are going to get there. We're probably going to get there sooner rather than later. But we still have a lot of hurdles to overcome before, you know, the economic data is positive enough that we can say that all of this heightened volatility, it is behind us. But for now, we have to stay defensive, and that's what we've been telling our clients.
Caterina, is that also because you expect, as some economists are predicting, that we're going to have a second deeper recession late next year? And just got about 25 seconds.
The question is, are we going to get a recession? And quite frankly, in our view, the best case scenario, if recession that we will get is not going to be as wide as we, you know, expect it to be. So we might get a recession. If it's not, you know, too prolonged, that's good news. That means that, you know, quicker recovery is on the horizon.
All right. So you don't think we're in a recession right now? Quick answer, yes or no?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Appreciate
that
being so quick. It
Not
does.
Yet. That's in there.
Katerina Simonetti, Senior VP and Private Wealth Advisor at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from Philadelphia.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.